Good morning, diners and travelers. You're well into the new year by now, I'm sure. We are, too, and we're bringing you a program that, what can we describe it as? It's non-themed.
Yeah, there you go.
it's just some interviews that we would like to get out there.
Exactly. That's exactly the point.
She's been getting so much attention on her latest book and also for her influence in the whole world of the culinary arts and baking in particular. And, of course, it's none other than Dori Greenspan, who's pretty much synonymous with the fine baking at this point. But also she does savories.
Well, this is an interesting book. It has a particularly interesting theme, which we won't spoil by telling you about. We'll just have Dori explain it.
Well, I'm going to go out on a limb here, Dori Greenspan, and I'm going to say of every single cookbook, especially baking books I've ever read, your books, the ones I trust.
Oh, thank you. That's the nicest thing you could say to me.
Well, they work. Your recipes work. I mean,
I work very hard to make them work.
Yeah, I was wondering how much testing you must do. It must be enormous.
No, it's interesting, particularly with, I mean, I always test, and I have someone, sometimes many someones, who retest after I think the recipe is perfect. Uh-huh. I send it to others to test. But it was particularly, testing for baking chamois, my new book, was particularly intense because the recipes were collected from friends and sources in France. And so I had to make sure that everything would work in America,
right,
with American ingredients. So it was, there's an extra level of testing that had to take place.
Well, this, you said that the name of the book is Baking Chamois, Recipes from My Paris Home to Your Home Anywhere. And, you know, when I heard that this was going to be your 11th book, I thought, what in the world is she going to put together for an 11th book? That's a lot of books.
It's a lot of books.
And a lot of recipes. And this turns out to be a little bit different from your other cookbooks. And why is that? Because you said just now, you got these recipes not from, well, some major chefs, but they're not like professional pastry, patisserie chef. They are
exactly
the French cook.
So you're absolutely right. This was a very different book for me. It's a little like the book that I wrote, my previous book, Around My French Table,
right,
which was recipes from friends and, you know, it was about home cooking in France. But writing Baking Chamois opened what I came to think of as a parallel universe to the pastries that we think of when we think of French pastry, when we think of the fancy, very polished pastries that professionals make that you can buy in the patisseries all over France. This is really home baking, and it's not really very well known because it's the kind of stuff that you only get to taste if you're in a French family or if someone French is treating you like family.
Yeah, I mean, it's like heresy. You say the French people don't bake. Is that what you said?
Well, they don't, but yeah, I said they don't bake anything fussy or finicky or elaborate. For that, they go to the pastry shop.
Right.
They don't bake, they buy.
Makes sense
but
to me.
If they're going to bake, they bake the simplest desserts. Poached fruits, very simple tarts. The crusts are always store bought.
That shocked me, actually.
The French are so clever about buying good quality things that, you know, buying store bought ingredients mixing them with something homemade. So I have only one friend in France who makes her own crust. Everyone else goes to the supermarket and buys these crusts. They're already rolled out. They're exactly the right size, exactly the right thickness, and they're made with all butter. One night we were going to, this is before I lived in Paris, so it's, you know, more than 20 years ago. Before I lived in Paris and before I knew what you could get from the supermarket, we went to a friend's house for dinner. My husband and I were already planning what we would have as a midnight snack because she was a famously bad cook. And she served a quiche. And the quiche was great, and the crust was so beautiful. And I said to her, oh, the crust, it's so great. How did you make it? And she said to me, oh, I'm so glad you like it. She never told me. And so it wasn't until we moved to Paris and I was shopping in the supermarkets that light bulb went off. And I realized, ah, that crust, store-bought. So when French people bake, they really bake simply. And so I was so happy to get these recipes from friends and to see that when they said simple, they meant it. These are really, I came to call this kind of baking French comfort baking. And it's really the kinds of sweets that I like. Dirty loaf cakes and tarts that are made very simply with fruit, maybe some crumb topping, cookies that are plain that you know, and good and just wholesome that you want to dunk in something delicious. I was very happy to get these recipes.
I like the dish you said, the pastry that changed my life. Tell us about that one.
Oh,
it's a little it's a little strawberry tarts, right?
That changed. And so I don't have a recipe. I got confused because it's not a recipe in the book. It's really the story of, I think of it as my Genesis story. So that I went to Paris for the very first time. It's over 40 years ago. And the first thing that I tasted was a tiny strawberry tart. It had three little wild strawberries on it. And it had pastry cream. And it was a little, like, boat-shaped tartlet. And I had never tasted anything like it. And it just made me want to taste everything French. And I'm still working on that goal.
Well, it's interesting. And I wanted to point that out because it's important for listeners to realize that this is not just a book of recipes about that we've been talking about. It's a series of stories as well. So it's like living the style of pastries and cakes in France, rather than just, and this is what you do if you want to make a quiche Lorraine or a sponge cake. So
thank you for saying that.
I think that makes it.
Thank
really
you for
important.
Pointing that out.
Good.
One of the things that I love to tell stories, and I love to tell stories that help people understand the context, help people to understand where the food came from. It's like I find, and I don't think I'm alone in this, I hope I'm not, that I find that I enjoy food even more if there's a story attached to it, if there's a tradition or a history or a person, something that actually, or custom, something that actually places the food in context. And because I wasn't born French, something that I have not stopped blaming my mother for.
You always say that.
But because I wasn't born French, I think I take nothing for granted. And so I try to observe everything. And I'm fascinated about learning new recipes and new traditions, and so I'm happy to be able to pass that along in my book.
Well, now you've got a variety of other special things that sort of thread through the book that I noticed. I don't know whether you call it this or not, but the blue pages. I'm colorblind, so they may not be blue. They might be purple. But they're very approximately blue. But there you provide general information that I guess is designed to get the person reading it in the right mood.
By the way, the pages are blue.
Oh, good. Good to know that.
It's blue, Robin.
Okay.
The blue pages, it's an opportunity, yes, for me to get people in the right mood, to put them in the place that I was when I either discovered a recipe or worked on it, also to give little hints and to talk about interesting terms or the history of a recipe. For instance, one of the blue pages talks about one of my favorite kind of genre of recipes, the financier, or I guess we would say financiers, or I'm not quite sure, but essentially stockbrokers.
Yeah.
The name financier is it means a stockbroker in French. And there are a whole bunch of delicious little sponge cakes that are called financier. And they were created for the first time in Paris in the mid-1800s. There was a pastry shop across the street from the stock exchange. And every afternoon, the stockbrokers would run in to grab a snack from the pastry shop and run back to work. And they would always complain that they couldn't eat things fast enough, that they needed a knife and a fork, and essentially they wanted a grab-and-go. Uh-huh. And so the pastry chef who owned the shop invented these little sponge cakes that could be eaten without getting crumbs all over the stockbroker's ties, and they wouldn't need a knife and fork, and they could eat them quickly. And he decided that he would name them for his clients, and so they're called financier, and he also decided he would make them as rich as his clients.
Uh-huh.
And so they have butter in them, a fair amount of butter. And I love stories like this. And so the blue pages have those kinds of stories.
Now, what's the difference between a blue page and what I call a brown sidebar? I mean, I'm on a roll here. I'm getting all the colors right.
Okay, wait a sec. Let me see. It's so funny. I was looking at my proof pages, which are black and white. I should send them to you. You would have no problem. What brown page are you looking?
They're more sort of additional explanation stuff, but they didn't quite qualify to make a blue page.
I think the designer had a very good time doing this. I tried, and I was really grateful to my publisher for allowing me to have blue pages and brown pages and a lot of room before recipes to talk about, the customs and the traditions, to have space to talk about ingredients. So one of the brown pages talks about rum. And
I remember reading that one.
Yeah, how rum is used in France and where the affection for it comes from. And, as I said, I'm grateful to have the space to write. I love being able to tell these stories as well as to provide recipes that I want everyone to go home and bake, and just share these things and enjoy them.
Well, now, with the Bonnie Days in there as well, see, I saw these guys too. You would never run out of recipes. I mean, you could be through the book and not get through it once if you followed all the different variations you're suggesting.
The Bonnie Days, the good ideas are variations. And when I was working on Baking Shame 1, all of my cookbook, I was thinking that I love to play around. I love to, I'll be working on something and think, oh, yeah, the rum was good, but, if I grated some orange zest in it and used some Grand Marnier, that would be good, too. And my husband always says to me, just stop and finish one recipe before you think of three variations for it. And so the Bunny Days, the good ideas, gives me a chance not only to suggest some variations, but to give home bakers, sometimes I think of it almost as permission, but to encourage home bakers to make the recipes their own, to use flavorings that they like, to play around with the shape of something. I love France. There's always the spécialité de maison, the house special. And I would love it if home bakers would have their own house specials.
Uh-huh. Now, you go into histories and some of the traditional desserts, French desserts, but you also talk about what you call the contemporary, more contemporary ideas about the food. And you, in that discussion, you start talking about some of these things that were rages currently in Paris including Philadelphia cream cheese.
So I... The most famous pastry chef in France is Pierre Hermain. He's somebody yes. that I've worked with. And Pierre would always ask me to bring him cream cheese. So I would lug 10 pounds of cream cheese to Paris, and I would give Pierre 5 or 6 pounds of it, and I would keep some for myself so that I could make New York-style cheesecake for my French friends. And they loved it, and they just loved it. And about, oh, I don't know, 2 years ago, cream cheese came to France, and it came to Paris in a really, really big way. So it was always called Philadelphia. It was never called just cream cheese. It was never called Kraft. It was always Philadelphia. And when Philadelphia became available, there were signs outside of supermarkets, and there was even an ad campaign for Philadelphia on the sides of the Paris buses.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so it was really a big deal. And so I had some fun with it, and I used it to show my French friends other things that they could do. So in addition to a New York-style cheesecake, I made a tart that had a no-bake cheesecake filling, a cream cheese filling, and I put blueberries and corn on top of it. I did that during the summer. I made rugelach for them so they could... see what that dough was, and I actually brought some, I talk about this in Baking Shame, well, I brought some on a flight from New York to Paris and gave it to the flight attendants as soon as we got settled. It always helps to get better service if you bring something delicious with you. And the attendants were, one of whom was a baker, and we talked a lot about baking, said to me she had thought it was puff pastry. She had never tasted a dough like that cream cheese dough.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so that really became, that cream, it was Philadelphia took Paris for a while.
That's interesting. Any other quirky things to report?
Not so much quirky, but I find really interesting. The éclair is really big in Paris now. There are stores, shops that sell only éclair.
Hasn't it
and
always
the same
been?
With,
how about cronuts?
Cronuts? Oh, cronuts.
Well, you know, he worked with Hermé, too, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
Yeah.
Dominique Ancel's cronut is trademarked, you know, so you're not supposed to do it.
Everybody's stealing.
Call it a cronut. But I saw one at a street fair in Paris, and I saw a cronut in Barcelona. So that's also kind of making the rounds.
It's one of those things you almost wish you never came up with because you're going to be haunted by it the rest of your career.
It's going to be that one thing that you can't take off the menu.
Exactly.
Ever.
And I think I saw in this book some sort of cereal covered with chocolate or something.
Oh, so this was getting these recipes from friends. I was surprised a lot, but this was one of the two recipes that surprised me the most. The recipe you're referring to is
that
called...
That surprised me.
Desert Roses.
Right.
Which sounds so romantic. It's cornflakes mixed with dried fruit and nuts and held together with melted butter and melted chocolate. And here's the thing about them. They are so good. They are so good. They are so much better than they have any right to be. They're delicious. Delicious. Just a little no-bake treat, but...
really
and they can eat milk chocolate, or,
isn't it? It's quite sacrilegious as a French pastry.
But I made them for Thanksgiving. We were 20 people for Thanksgiving, and I made them along with pies and tarts, and they were the first thing to go. Everybody loved them.
Wow. It's really funny. It's a little bit like my mother was not a great cook, but she did master some dessert recipes. And one of our favorites, I think it was one of those things that came off the back of a box of something like macaroni and cheese, but it was called broken biscuit cake. And basically, you could get almost all the biscuits you wanted that were broken. This is back in the day when you used to select your biscuits out of the box.
This is an England
sloping towards you. Well, it probably happened here, didn't grocery stores used to have, they had the whole box of cookies, the whole box of crackers, cookies, biscuits, and you could get all the broken, and then it was all mixed up with the chocolate. And then it had chocolate icing on top of the end as well. I think Heather still, I think Aaron, one of our nieces still makes it. It was always a great, favorite. And of course, one of the things that made it one of my mother's favorites is it was cheap. She was very thrifty.
Thrifty. We say thrifty. We don't say cheap.
Here's how I'm going to finish up, because I know I wanted you to tell one story, and you said you were embarrassed and you didn't want to do that. So here's what we're going to do, listeners. We're going to have you find the story on the internet, and then you'll know the secret is why are beignets known as nuns' beignets, and how did it come about that they were invented? So I'm sure there's a wiki or there's some information out there that you'll find. And Dory, we got you off the hook there.
And you know, if they don't want to do it on the internet, they can always go to Dory Greenspan's new book, Baking Chez Moi.
Because you put it in the book.
I did put it in the book.
Well, it was a delight. To have you on the program with us, Dory. And we wish Mr. Greenspan and yourself the very happiest of happy holidays.
and your son, the cookie genius.
The cookie genius. Thank you. We will all be together in Paris for the holidays.
That's wonderful. Great.
And we'll be celebrating there. And I wish you the very best and the most delicious holidays.
Thank you.
And we'll be back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Let's suggest that Dory Greenspan is one of the most enduring of influences and forces in the culinary world. And we're going to jump from that into another enduring legacy, this being in Italian liqueurs, on the Molinari family.
And so if you've always puzzled when you came back from Italy about where you could get wonderful
limoncello.
Or that wonderful Zambuca with the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost coffee beans in it, here's the company that's most likely responsible. Mario Molinari, welcome to On the Menu Radio. How are you this afternoon?
Thank you. I'm very well. And as I said, I'm a bit tired, but I'm okay.
And sadly, because Benito Mussolini is no longer with us, the train did not run on time.
Yeah. Well, someone said that he should have been working in the train sector then, rather than being a politician.
Yeah, exactly. Now, we're talking to Mario about Zambuca and limoncello and something else, which his family has been making since around about 1920. I want first of all to have our listeners understand exactly what these products are, because they're not truly distillates like brandy.
No,
and it's a mix, sort of a mixture. Go ahead and explain, Mario.
Yeah, it's basically an infusion. So I'm talking about Sambuca. Sambuca is an infusion, while limoncello di Capri is a maceration. So okay. What is the difference? Infusion is mixing in a warm temperature, I would say hot temperature, alcohol and herb and sugar.
Right.
While maceration is different because when you also mix alcohol, in our case only with lemon peels, but it's not hot. So it takes a longer time, like 10 days more or less, so that the essential oils that are contained in the lemon peels can come out and give that great flavor to the limoncello di Capri.
Well, thank you for that. Thank you for that explanation, because I couldn't have put it into. I sort of understood, but I couldn't put it into words correctly. Now, the thing that amazed me is that these products are really relatively new. Your grandfather, if I'm understanding correctly, actually invented Zambuca in the year 1920. Now it seems like surely Italians have been drinking Zambuca since forever, but that's really not true.
Well, the thing is that actually the inventor of Zambuca was not my grandfather, was a guy that was a friend of Garibaldi, whose name was Luigi Manzi,
okay.
who made a Sambuca called Manzi Sambuca.
Uh-huh.
And back in the 80s, we bought that brand. Let's say that Molinari was the first Sambuca that became a brand in Italy, and that's why it's recognized as the Sambuca among Italians. Yes.
Go ahead now. Let's switch to limoncello. Limoncello goes back only to 1945.
Well, limoncello was actually invented by, well, one of the inventors. Of course, it was a traditional liqueur that was made all over the Neapolitan area of Italy. But let's say that one of the inventors back in the, at the end of the 19th century was Vincenza Canale, which is
right.
the great grandmother of our partner, Massimo Canale. She had a very small and very nice hotel, and the family still owns that hotel with all the, you know, the lemon trees that are in the garden. And so she used to make limoncello for her guests, and they, you know, they loved it very much. And then her grandson put it in a bottle and sold it, and they became limoncello. You know, they went into the industry of limoncello, even if I have to say that if you see the factory, is a laboratory more than a factory. It's a very small one, and you can see, you know, handcraft everywhere, because it is a very small one. You can see, you know, all the lemons, the peasant spring the lemons, and it's very small and nice.
Now there's a third product which rounds out your offering, and it's kind of interesting because the people who know Sambuca well know that you're supposed to put float three coffee beans in your Sambuca.
Yes,
I didn't realize that was in honor of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, three of them.
Yes, well, there are many interpretations. Of course, you know, the idea is to create a sort of ritual that was very good for, you know, the consumption of the product. And so my grandfather started talking about also the good luck, because the, you know, three is a sort of magic number. Not only in Italy, but I would say everywhere.
Okay.
As you correctly said, you know, it's also, there's also some religious reference. And so, but, you know, beside the ritual, I would say that, you know, the chewing the coffee beans is quite good, because it has, I mean, coffee beans have a bitter flavor.
Yes.
That marries very well the flavor of the sweetness of Sambuca Molinari.
Will I get bad luck if I put in five?
No. Well, here they say that they should be 1, 3, 5, never, you know, two, never per number, 2, 4.
Okay.
But I don't know why, you know.
I'll have to remember that now.
That's what my dad told me. But of course, you know, when I asked him why, he doesn't know. But that's how it has always been done.
No, I guess it's not surprising then that there's a third product in your family of products, which is a version of Sambuca
Cafe,
but heavily yeah. infused with coffee. Now tell us about
Cafe,
that one.
Yes.
Tell
Cafe Molinari is this is again a very, I would say is a quite old product in our portfolio, because my grandfather started making it back in the 60s. Then during the 70s we stopped the production for a while, and then, you know, we came back with the same recipe, only we went down with the alcohol. But, you know, according to the current European laws, we don't want to call it Sambuca, even if there is anise in it, because the European law in the article 110 says that Sambuca must be a colorless liqueur. So there are some producers that are making colored Sambuca, mostly with artificial coloring, and we don't do that, and we think we are in favor of a strict interpretation of the law says that the sambuca needs to be colorless.
Now there's
so we just call it liquore caffè.
There's a secret somewhere. There's a secret recipe for zambuca somewhere.
The thing is that we have a sort of a tradition in our family where only one person per generation knows the recipe of Molinari Extra Sambuca.
Now, is that you?
No, it's not me. It's my brother. He was my uncle and was my grandfather.
Okay. So you can't have a falling out, otherwise there'd be no product, right?
Exactly. This thing surprises because Angelo, my brother, is the one that, physically still makes the product. And it's sort of unbelievable for the best-selling liqueur in the Italian market.
No, is nobody else
according?
Is nobody else allowed in the room when he's making it? Then, I mean, how does this work? I would have thought that we could watch him and figure it out.
There can be someone else in the room, but only not following the whole process.
Okay.
And there is a lab where he can only get in. Where he carries all the ingredients, nobody is allowed to enter there.
Okay.
He even cleans it by himself.
Now this communication that we're having right now is not just it didn't just happen by accident. It happened because somehow or other you're trying to launch more and more of your wonderful products here in the U.S. market. Yes. Is that what's going on?
Yes, yes. We have a great importer called Van Gogh Imports, producer of Van Gogh vodka, and with the person of Norman Bonchik, who is the CEO of that company, and we are trying. I think we all believe he's doing a great job, and actually, Molinari Extra. There will be also someone to say about the extra denomination that was given to us by the Italian authorities back in the 70s, because we were considered the best spirit in Italy. But he's doing the Van Gogh company is really helping us, and we are relaunching it. I wouldn't say we are launching it because we have been in the market for several years now. But for some reason, after the late 80s, beginning of the 90s, where we had really interesting volumes, the brand went down. We've been changing too many importers, and now it's the first time that we have someone that we can trust, and a company that really treats our brands with tender loving care.
Well, I think that's terrific news, because I'm sure a lot of people who visited Italy in the years when you were not so active overseas probably really had a desperate problem that they couldn't get the Zambuca that they love when they were in Italy once they came home. And once they'd drunk everything, all the ones they brought home in their suitcase, that was over.
Yeah, you're right. The only thing that worries me is that we're probably going to reduce our sales in Italy, because all those Americans will have to buy it in United States. but it's okay.
Well, we know you've had a long and difficult day with trains that didn't run on time. You only just got home. It's well into the evening in Italy. We thank you so much for calling us.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure, and thank you.
Oh, grazie mille.
Grazie a te.
And I'm drinking with 1, 3, or 5, not 2, 4, and 6.
Exactly.
Thank you, Mario, so much.
Mario, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Ciao.
Bye-bye. Ciao, bye.
And we're going to stay with beverages right after the break, so don't go away. We'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net. Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, while some spirits and beverages have been around for quite a long time, there's a slew of brews being created even as we speak. One of these is a gin called Common Decency. Don't you love that name? And we're going to talk to its creator, John Wabeck, who is an interesting guy in his own right. John Wabeck. Did I do that right?
Yes.
Anyhow, you have been on my radar for quite a long time. Finally, we pinned you down to get you to do this interview. You have a fascinating background. You started out as a chef. You're now everything from a spirits inventor or designer to a bar program director. Could you just give us sort of a brief summation of your resume?
I'll do this quick. I first went to school for music at 18 years old or whatever, and that didn't work for a lot of various reasons. And then 18 years old, you got to get a job, so you work in a restaurant, and I decided I liked it. But then everyone I was working with was still at the same, 20 years older than me, and I was like, I don't want to be these people. I need to figure out a way to move ahead. And that's not being negative, I just, that wasn't exactly what I wanted to do. Then went to Culinary Institute of America, graduated a long, long time ago, and moved to D.C. and cooked and made it to, got promoted to sous chef, executive sous chef, and then started taking on my own kitchens. And then always had an interest in wine, and when I moved to Napa Valley to be a chef at a restaurant called Bricks out there.
Great name for a wine restaurant.
Yeah, I think so. My wife at the time worked at the French Laundry, and I got invited to go to the wine tastings where Bobby Stuckey, who's now a master sommelier, was running these tastings. And it was nervous just being in the French Laundry when they're closed, and then it was nervous being around all these servers that were so knowledgeable about wine. And again, I thought I knew a lot, and I realized that I didn't. Then kept going to the tastings and started to do okay. And Bobby, who is one of the best service people I know anywhere, when we decided to move back to D.C., after a few years, he gave me the name of somebody to look up and also, put me in the right direction of taking the first level of the quartermaster sommeliers, the intro level. And I took that and was still doing cooking and managed to get through that and then passed what is now the third level, advanced, and like, okay, I got through this, I can get, and mind you, I was still cooking, but studying for this test is a full-time job in and of itself. Went to take master's for the first time, did really, really badly. Walked out of the room during service after just tanking it terribly and decided I have to make a choice here. Do I want to pursue wine or do I want to keep cooking? And chose wine. And pretty much the next day I went back in the kitchen. It was actually fun because, okay, I don't have to, there's a finite amount of time I'm going to be doing this. And then it actually became really fun. And then my first wine job was a restaurant that opened in Tyson's Corner. Called Inox, and this was when the economy was great in 2007 or 2008, and I had a lot of money with which to do a wine list, and the list was, I don't think restaurants can really open with this list anymore, of like 750 or 800 labels. And,
oh, wow.
lots of money of inventory, and that was my first full-time wine job, and then just kept going. And unfortunately, we closed because the market crashed like the first week we opened, and we just never really recovered from it, and just did wine. And, still taking the MS test, and now I live in Pittsburgh, and the kind of the stars aligned. I mean, Willow's a lot of fun, and Grit and Grace is a lot of fun, and I have,
Well, tell us, you jumped in there. You started out just a spoon, right?
Yeah, just a spoon as, I needed, obviously was moving to Pittsburgh, and I'm like, if I'm going to work somewhere, it has to be a good place. And Brian and I kind of clicked right away. And
Brian
is
the chef.
Brian Pekarsik,
and he's also a co-owner with Rick Stern. And
yep.
It's now, I always get mixed up. Is it S and P or P and S?
S&P. Salt and pepper.
Salt and pepper. Okay. That's the restaurant group. And you have.
Now we should perhaps explain, by the way, listeners, in case you're wondering, talking to us from at least 300 yards away. at least if he's at Spoonie, it's just right down the street.
And Barnum, I clicked, and the only thing I had to do was run Spoon Dining Room, improve the service, and deal with the wine list. And now that's grown to manage both those places, oversee the beverage programs at Grit and Willow. And
Grit is Grit and Grace, and it's Grit, the downtown restaurant. And the latest one is a stunning restaurant called Willow. And all these, I might mention, are Pittsburgh restaurants.
Yeah. As far as job keeps me busy, but, it's fun because three distinct, separate, wine lists are all different, and the cocktail programs are all different as well. So it's a lot of fun, and it's a lot of work, but there's a lot of reward to it as well.
Well, you deal with cocktails as much as you do with wine, right?
Yeah, unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on the day it is, the cocktail program at Spoon, using my background as cooking, pretty much every cocktail that we do that is ours, even Manhattans and Martinis and things, we making our own bitters for the most part, making all our vermouths. We don't buy vermouth anymore. And there's always...
Yeah, vermouth having a big comeback, I hear.
Yeah. We're really happy with our stuff.
Yeah, you can do it on the rocks now without guilt or embarrassment.
Yeah. Right. That's something... Something is cooked in pretty much every cocktail that we do, or somehow tweaked, in a culinary manner. And that's kind of fun, but it's also a lot of work.
Right, it is.
Are you doing any barrel aging? We know some people in town are doing barrel aging of Negronis and Manhattans.
I've dabbled in that personally, and I'm sure I'll take a beating for this, but I don't really see much of the benefit for it, but... That's me. The vermouth is specifically made for Manhattan, and we certainly have a particular spirit when people ask for it, and it's one of those things that everyone can barrel age stuff that they don't know or that they don't make, but with us is there's a reason behind pretty much everything that we do.
Sure. No, I've heard people say that you have to be very careful when you do that, because if you're using a very small cask, then your liquor is going to get woody pretty quick.
Yeah, and more power to people that want to do it. I've tried it once or twice, and I just don't really see the benefit. But
you are an inventor of spirits, nevertheless. So that's a segue to the fact that you decided that you are interested in creating a new beverage, or at least a new entry in an old class beverage called London Dry Gin. So tell us about why it's called Common Decency, and then some more about it.
That came about, Rick Stern sent me an email about Midnight Madness that approached him about doing custom spirits. My first reaction was, wow, they're going to make, and this isn't them at all, but my first reaction was they're going to have big tanks of vodka and big tanks of bad gin and put it in a bottle, slap a label on it, and sell it. And I'm like, well, I don't really want to do that. And I had a couple meetings with them, and I'm like, just bring base spirits, and we'll assess the quality, and then we can go from there. And, we did that.
I should know, but what is Midnight Madness?
They're the people who make it.
It's a custom distiller in Quakertown, PA, north of Philly. We had a couple meetings with them, and went really quick once we decided to do it. The gin itself, before I moved to Pittsburgh, a very good friend of mine and I were starting to... But this has been happening with a couple of different teams of people, but making our own gin, either... leasing someone still, we are in talks with someone in Virginia to use their still on off days to distill this, and then another friend of mine and I were going to do dry gin, and he actually found a way to get somebody to do him a couple of samples, and it was, the base recipe was his, and he subsequently decided he didn't want to do that, and now he works at RDV Winery in Virginia. It's beautiful, great wines. I said, what botanicals did we use? I don't remember. And he actually sent me his recipe, and I remembered from tasting it, we don't want to use I would tweak this, I would tweak this, I would tweak this. So it's not very close to the original one, but, you know, we tweaked it and very quickly honed in on the final product. And the comedy on this is, you know, we just put, I had a label going that I did, and I'm not very artistically talented, and the label looked like it was terrible. And two of my servers are like, you can't do that. We'll have this. I was like, well, I need it by tomorrow morning. So they stayed up all night and did a label for me, and it looks great. Like, I woke up at 7 o'clock to, like, 15 emails of different labels, and I'm like, let's try this, add this, and boom, done. But they put Pittsburgh Dry Gin on the label, which hopefully the TTB isn't listening. But I'm not sure that that's – well, it's not a legal category of gin. So maybe it is now, because it's on a federally approved bottle of gin. So maybe we invented a new category of gin.
Now, just to explain for those listeners who don't realize the way that you make gin, you do a first distillation to produce essentially a grain neutral spirit from whatever cereal you're using, and then in a secondary fermentation you add the botanicals that will give it the flavor that you want.
Exactly.
Am I right there? We went to a gin distillery, Coal Creek, I think.
Oh, yeah.
In Maine. And
they're great.
And we saw their entire process, and they explained how it all worked.
That's good stuff.
Yeah, I like Coal Creek.
I like both their vodka and their gin.
And there was another gin. There was another gin we liked that came from England. Was it called Brokers?
Oh, Brokers. Yeah. We sell Brokers by the truckload.
Yeah.
It's a cute bottle.
I'm tasting a similarity between Common Decency and Brokers. It seems like they're really quite similar.
Yeah, I mean, London Dry is a category that a lot of people don't want to mess with, because it's like, well, why would I do that? There's so many of them out there. But they're all, it's like, okay, why do people collect Pinot Noir? I mean, yeah, it tastes like Pinot Noir, but they're all subtly different in their own way. I mean, I think we're up to 33 gins at Spoon now, which in the grand scheme of things for most restaurants is a lot. But as far as restaurants that actually have huge gin collections, I think the record is like 400 and something.
Oh, wow.
We're not going to do that. But, you know, we're still slowly but surely one or two here and there, just as they become available.
Well, now I read that you view the perfect gin and tonic as a London Dry, yours preferably, with Schweppes.
Well, Schweppes, it depends on the restaurant I worked previously, the last place I cooked, New Heights, and we did kind of similar thing, but we were using just bottled tonics. We make our own tonics at Spoon, but we have like six different bottled tonics as well. And for me, the key is, you want to match the dryness of the gin, so obviously London Dry is going to be really dry, to the dryness of the tonic. So Fever Tree and Brokers is great.
Yeah, I like Fever Tree. But Schweppes I find too sweet.
Well, if the gin isn't all the way dry, like Brokers is probably a little too dry for Schweppes, but if you have something like Tanqueray or Bombay, Schweppes is fine. I mean, we've done experiments. By experiments, I mean made gin and tonics. But, you know, if you have a gin that's, say, really wet, and what's a good one that everyone would know? Well, Hendrix, I mean, most people know that. If you do Hendrix and Fever Tree, I don't think it works as well, because it's just too dry. Or the Fever Tree is too dry. So if you use something that's a little sweeter, it actually matches very well.
Okay, so it's a definite choice on your part to say it's actually better. Now, people have actually told us that English Schweppes is different again from American Schweppes.
Oh, absolutely it is. The one time I've had that, and that for me is the holy grail of tonic water.
Okay.
I don't think anyone's ever said that before, but I've been to France a bunch of times, and it's always wine business. And the last time I was in France, it's day 12 of a 12-day trip. I don't feel like having a glass of wine anymore because I'm done with it.
Oh, good. I feel the same way.
Well, I've never said that before, but, you know, I have a gin and tonic. And then we were at Hilton Arc de Triomphe, let's say, I think it was. And I just ordered a gin and tonic, and nicely presented, you know, gin in the glass with ice and then tonic on the side, and I didn't think about it. And this really made me a little cranky because, you know, I've had this tonic water once, but it was the Schweppes Indian tonic, which has more quinine than the FDA will allow.
Oh, yeah.
Now, you want to talk about gin and tonic.
That's it, huh?
that's it. And I've had it once, and that's kind of the, you know,
well,
that's
the whole point of quinine and tonic was is malaria.
I'm never going to get malaria, trust me.
That's how it got popular with the English.
In fact, it's the reason that fever tree is called fever tree.
Right.
Yeah.
But there's one last question before we hang up, and Anne wants me to ask it, and I suspect I know the answer, and it's probably disappointing. But how, aside from going to one of your restaurants and having a common decency in a cocktail, is it actually possible for an individual person to buy some for their consumption at home?
I don't believe so. If you buy a bottle of wine and you don't finish it, you can take it. But I don't know how that corresponds with liquor, to be perfectly honest.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
And we had a gin launch on Monday for a Jorge, a Spanish gin from Mahon, which is superb as well. And people were wanting to buy that. You can buy that through Dreadnought. And Common Decency, you know, people were here for gin. There's probably 30 people here. And they're like, well, let's taste your gin. Well, how can we buy this too? And they were, you know, I need to look at the legality of this, but like I said, poring over law books is not really my specialty.
Right.
Well, off the air with nobody listening, we'll figure out if we can do a trade of English Indian tonic water.
Well, you have the accent to be able to purchase that. I'm American. I can't do it.
Well, we'll be over there, so we'll bring some back.
Well, then I'm pretty sure we can look into the possibility of this.
Okay. John, thank you for talking to us.
And, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and hope to see you soon.
I hope so as well. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, we've been messing around with sweet of one kind or another throughout this program, sweetheart, right?
Yes.
So I guess there's no way to finish up other than that we should insert something really sweet.
Yeah, but you know, we don't usually deal with giant corporations like this. But I think it's really an interesting perspective. Here we have a company called Häagen-Dazs, which in a way was a ploy to get its attention. I mean, it's not.
It pretended to be
pretended
to be very small and very European, and then all of a sudden
it burst into the scene.
To be really big.
Yeah, it burst into the scene to break up the dominance of companies like Borden's and so forth. And here we have all these artisanal producers on the scene to challenge Häagen-Dazs. And so let's talk to Häagen-Dazs and see
how they're responding.
We're talking to Joy Richardson about Häagen-Dazs line of ice creams and gelatos. Joy, I was thinking when I got the notice about the new flavors and the release of the gelato style about how different the foodscape has become from when Häagen-Dazs originally launched. Can you give us a little bit of the history thoughts on it? Were that Häagen-Dazs was a very small company when it launched, because I remember having a hard time getting it in Philadelphia. But then it grew so much and is now not owned but licensed to Nestle, which is a giant in the field. Is that a correct view of what Häagen-Dazs started out to be?
Yes, so the Häagen-Dazs brand was founded by Reuben Mattis, who was a young entrepreneur in New York. And he was working for his mother's frozen ice, fruit ice pop business. However, Reuben had a vision of launching a brand that stood for quality and craftsmanship, and so therefore he launched the Häagen-Dazs brand under the Häagen-Dazs name in New York. And so the brand is over 50 years old, and while Nestle now manages the brand under a license agreement, we still make sure to uphold the values that the brand stands for today and has always stood for.
Where does the name come from?
Reuben Mattis actually made up the name, and a lot of consumers find it to have a, you know, a European-inspired name, and that was all done strategically by Reuben Mattis. So his vision to launch a brand that stood for the finest quality ingredients and craftsmanship, he felt that Europe stood for a lot of those things, and what the people of Europe produce out of things from there. So they took that and used it as a way to make a brand in the United States that would have that aura of thoughtfully crafted products.
Yeah, he fooled us, didn't he, sweetheart? So he was very successful, and we're two reasonably sophisticated people, so he blew that right by us. We assumed it must be European and it must be special because it had such a fancy name. And as Anne was saying, before we came on the air, the biggest problem was, depending on where we lived at the time, finding it in a store was a challenge. I'm guessing that that's no longer true.
Correct. So when he launched the brand, you know, like I said, it was to really convey an aura of old world traditions and craftsmanship, but it was something that he truly was dedicated to and he believed in. So it wasn't so much, of course, to trick people into, but it was something that was very important to him, and he just wanted to make sure that it was a new brand and people were also going to be intrigued by it.
Now, as I've started out by setting the scene for this, food landscape is totally different from when he launched Häagen-Dazs. And you have probably, I don't know how I would estimate it, percentage increase in competition, and mainly from the smaller, more artisanal markets.
That's correct.
So your strategy was what?
Well, Häagen-Dazs obviously is one of the largest ice cream brands in the world. And within the super premium ice cream category, which is growing in the marketplace, and that's driven by a lot of smaller new regional ice cream brands that are being launched and gaining distribution through word of mouth. As a brand, we have obviously a very high brand awareness with our consumers in the U.S. and also internationally. And in an effort to make sure that we stay relevant and we continue to bring new news and new products to our consumers while still adhering to those very important values that we stand for, we've had to make a very conscious effort to keep up to date on what the new trends are in the ice cream category, listen to what our consumers and what are the needs and wants that they are looking for in ice cream, and make sure that we're delivering the best that we can deliver based on what our consumers are telling us that they're interested in.
Translate that, if you would, into actual products.
So, for example, over the past 3 years, the gelato category has been booming exponentially in the United States. The Häagen-Dazs brand actually launched gelato back in the early 90s when it was owned by Pillsbury under General Mills. And it was way before its time, so the brand actually discontinued the gelato line. While it did fairly well, a lot of consumers just didn't quite understand what it was and what the difference between gelato and ice cream was. Even though it was very popular and it's an old world tradition for Italy, I think it was Häagen-Dazs was a little bit too ahead of the game in the United States. And so they discontinued the line. And so in 2013, we decided to relaunch Häagen-Dazs Gelato. However, we launched it with entirely new formulas and new flavors and new packaging to meet the needs of what was happening in today's ice cream category and the gelato category in particular. So while gelato is something that the brand launched over decades ago, it felt like the right thing to do back in, you know, a couple of years ago, because it's gaining more momentum, more popularity in the United States, and more consumers are looking for more niche regional brands that offer gelato because it's becoming more and more popular and consumers do know what gelato stands for. And so we wanted to be the first nationally distributed brand that offered a gelato line that is thoughtfully crafted and using the finest, best ingredients sourced from around the world.
What are some of the points that you had to meet in competition with these other companies? Like, are we talking Jenny's Splendid ice cream, or what ice creams are we talking about?
I would say a handful of smaller regional brands, but Talenti and Jenny.
Oh, I love Talenti.
Ice creams and gelatos are fantastic, and they're definitely competitors to within the ice cream category. But Häagen-Dazs has its own brand positioning, and knowing that we stand for the finest ingredients and thoughtfully crafted for over 50 years is something that does set us apart.
I mean, how do you compare price-wise with Talenti?
Price-wise, we're about line priced. Häagen-Dazs, a 14-ounce carton, sells for $4.99.
Now, you also, don't you have them in like a paddle pop format as well?
A what?
You know, there's little things on sticks.
Oh, ice cream bar?
Well, don't you have gelato bars?
Yeah, you have an ice cream. They have an ice cream.
We offer both packaged ice cream and ice cream bars, which does make Häagen-Dazs a little more unique within the ice cream category. Some brands only offer packaged ice cream, and other brands may only offer snacks or ice cream bars. But Häagen-Dazs has a really fantastic breadth of a portfolio that offers both. And we're happy to announce that this month in September of 2014, we are launching our first gelato bar line. And so we're launching with three flavors, and they are fantastic.
Well, then there you go. I thought we already had some.
Where are they? What are the flavors you're talking about?
The three flavors for the gelato bar line are a vanilla caramel pizzelle, which is a vanilla gelato, and it has two kind of golden caramel ribbons down the center of the gelato bar, and it's dipped in a milk chocolate and then enrobed in pizzelle cookie pieces, which are Italian-inspired from Italy. So they're kind of these crunchy pizzelle chopped-up cookies that are enrobed in the milk chocolate.
Enrobed. It's very noble.
Yes, and then we also offer a tiramisu dark chocolate and a strawberry dark chocolate.
They all sound like winners to me. I think Signor Talenti would be proud. you know who he is, right? And why Talenti is called that?
No, I actually do not.
Signor Talenti actually invented it. He was the chef to Catherine de' Medici.
Oh, how interesting.
Who was an Italian princess who married the King of France. And he built her a very large palace just so that she wouldn't feel lonely. Her entire kitchen staff came with her to France, and hence ice cream and gelato found their way into the mainstream, because French cooking and French, I guess, anything French was considered extraordinarily sophisticated, and that's when it all got off the ground, and that's why the guys at Talenti called it that. I always forget the name of the guy who invented it.
Talenti.
Now I remember. His name was Talenti. So he made it as a treat for a queen.
That's a great story. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah, and the man's name wasn't Häagen-Dazs.
That was a little
side joke. Oh, dear. Just a little aside there that obviously, that little joke missed the mark, obviously.
Well, Joy, I mean, I wish you much success with your new line. I mean, I have a soft spot in my heart for Häagen-Dazs because that was the first premium ice cream product that I ever really was exposed to. So
that's great. Did you come across the brand through our Häagen-Dazs shops, or was it from buying in the grocery store?
You mean originally?
Yeah.
Oh wow! How did we?
It must have been in the grocery store. Yeah. I mean, I don't know whether you knew about it before we met or not.
I think it was in New York. I encountered it. And then,
oh, yep.
And then I lived in Philadelphia and couldn't find it. And then I talked the market into trying to get some for me because it was a real find. Oh, well.
Yeah, but who is the one you used to like, the Mr. something or other machine?
What?
There was the guy whose schedule you knew.
Oh, no. I forgot about him.
Well,
the good humor man.
It's really funny because these new, what should we call them? You can hardly call them gelato on sticks, but I guess that's what they are. But they sound very complicated. They sound more like Good Humor bars.
Yeah, well.
And I explained to my wife the effect of Good Humors on waistlines, and she stopped eating them, but she's going to break that rule. I can promise you with with these new gelatos on a stick from Häagen-Dazs. And as Anne said, we wish you a great success, not just here in these United States, but around the world. They sound like
great
winners.
Thank you very much.
And that's it. Another On the Menu program wrapped in our 12th year. We're delighted that you were part of our audience again this year. And we'll hope to see you again same time, same place next week. And until then,
bye-bye.